Okay, well, welcome to Newcastle Christian Students. My name's Martin. I'm a staff worker with NCS, and I'm really glad you're all here, especially if this is the first time you've come along. Maybe you joined us for the Mark Drama last week, and you're here because you heard about this talk at the Mark Drama. Well, I'm glad you're here. This talk's going to be a little bit different from the talks I usually give, because it's not a sermon. I'm not going to be preaching at you. It's more of a lecture. I'm trying to take off my preacher's hat and put on a historian's hat, although probably the preacher's hat's still hidden away there somewhere, because I do believe Jesus rose from the dead. I think it's important. I'm convinced it's important, and I want you to believe it too. But what I'm going to be doing today is trying to ask the kind of questions historians ask about these claims about Jesus' resurrection. And historians will approach the Bible. They use the Bible. This is the it contains the main sources we have for information about Jesus. But historians approach the Bible with slightly different presuppositions to believing Christians. That is, when I preach a sermon from the Bible, I preach it as a believing Christian. I believe the Bible is the word of God, that it's all true, it's infallible, and I preach it as that. But historians approach the Bible not that way, not with that presupposition, but treating it as they do any other historical source, or collection of sources, I should say, because there are multiple sources in the Bible. So that's what we'll be doing today. Now, a bit about the genesis of this talk. My thinking here began as a paper I prepared last year on the resurrection for some postgraduate study I'm doing in ancient history. I have a copy of that paper here. It's 30 pages long. I have a few copies, not enough for everyone, but if you're motivated enough and think you'll read it, you're welcome to take one. It has all the quirks of having been written for an examiner, that is the sort of gratuitous footnotes about what other people think here and there, but it does contain good information, I think, and it's the information that's sort of the foundation of this presentation, although I'll be approaching it a little bit differently at points today. What we're talking about is the resurrection of Jesus. Now, I've got probably 2 hours worth of material here, so we'll see how we go, and I will have a question time during the lunch hour afterwards at some point. So we'll just get through what we can. Consider historically, there are two historical claims in the Gospels that historians need to consider. That is the empty tomb that on the Sunday morning after Jesus' crucifixion, his tomb was empty. There was no body there. Some women went to the tomb, they found the stone rolled away, Jesus' body was gone. And the second claim, the resurrection appearances, that both on that Sunday and for a number of weeks following, or days or weeks following, Jesus appeared and showed himself to be alive to his disciples on a number of occasions. Now, there's kind of two reasons it's worth dividing those two things, the empty tomb and the resurrection appearances. First, there's just a phenomenological logic to it. That is, they're different experiences. Discovering a tomb to be empty and the body gone is a different experience to seeing that body walking around alive again and touching it and hearing it speak and so on. So they're different experiences. But also there's a literary logic to the division, because when it comes to the gospel accounts, there's a much greater degree of overlap in their accounts of the empty tomb than there is of the resurrection. And you can see that laid out in the table in the middle of the first page of your outline, under the point Jesus' resurrection in the gospels. I've just tried to summarise the events that we have in the four gospels that we find in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. I've listed Mark first, and the events they record. You'll see there that all four gospels record women visiting Jesus' tomb and finding it to be empty. Luke and John also record a subsequent visit by some men, including Peter, to the tomb and discovering it to be empty, confirming what the women had said. And then there are a series of appearances. Now, Mark doesn't have any appearances recorded in Mark's gospel if it ends at verse 8. Matthew records two. One to the women who had visited the tomb in chapter 28, verses 9 and 10, and one to the 11 disciples and perhaps others as well on a mountain in Galilee. Luke records four appearances, or what are probably four appearances, to two disciples on the road to Emmaus, to Peter, which is kind of mentioned, although not described in any detail, to the... I've got a spelling mistake. How annoying. Anyway, to the disciples in Jerusalem. I think that's probably the disciples minus Thomas. It's on the day of Jesus' resurrection. And the ascension at Bethany. And John records four as well. To Mary Magdalene. To the disciples minus Thomas in Jerusalem. To the disciples plus Thomas 8 days later in Jerusalem. And to seven disciples at the Sea of Tiberias in Galilee. So that's what we have in the Gospels themselves. And so just looking at that table, you'll see that it kind of lines up for the empty tomb. All four describe that. But when it comes to the resurrection appearances, there's a little bit of overlap, but mostly Gospels are talking about different appearances of Jesus. So it's helpful to distinguish between the empty tomb and the appearances. There's a second distinction that's helpful to make, and that's between an event itself and the early beliefs about that event. There's two different questions. Early beliefs: what did the early Christians believe about these things? The event itself: what actually happened? What happened that gave rise to their beliefs? And not everyone will think those two are the same. So, for example, Kersip Lake, he's a scholar who was writing at the start of the last century, he said, yes, early Christians did believe in the empty tomb, but why did they believe that? Because the women went to the wrong tomb. They didn't go to Jesus' tomb, they went to the wrong tomb, found it to be empty, and concluded that Jesus' body wasn't there. He said, well, they early Christians, there were appearances of a sort, but they were spiritual experiences, appearances of Jesus, not bodily appearances. He hadn't actually bodily raised. But when they had these spiritual experiences, and it was combined with the women's report that the tomb was empty, they ended up with a belief in the bodily resurrection of Jesus. So Kersip Lake, for him, the early belief differs from the event itself. Now, not many have really followed Lake in his thesis there, because for a number of reasons, one of which is if the women had gone to the wrong tomb, it would have been very, very easily falsified. And the first thing that happens in two of the Gospels when the women come back with a report is that the men run off and check for themselves. It wouldn't have been long before the body of Jesus appeared. In any case, there you have it. It's helpful to distinguish between early belief and the event itself. Now, I won't go into Gould and Wright there because I think I've made that point, but you can talk about it with me later if you like. So, we're going to be asking about these two events, the empty tomb and the resurrection appearances, and those two questions: what did the early Christians believe, and what was the nature of the event itself? Now, my main aim for this talk really is to try and convince you that the widespread early Christian belief was that Jesus' tomb was empty and that he appeared bodily to his disciples. And by early Christian belief, I mean the belief at the very beginnings of Christianity, in those first days after Jesus' crucifixion, those early days. And I want to focus our investigation on the four Gospels found in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, because that's where we find our narratives that tell us about the empty tomb and the appearances. But there are, just before we get into them, there are three types of material in the New Testament that in one respect are earlier than the Gospels. If the Gospels were written in the 60s, 70s, 80s AD, that kind of time period, there is written evidence, written material in the New Testament that is earlier than that. What does it say about the resurrection? Well, here are three types of evidence from the New Testament that show that belief in Jesus' resurrection preceded the writing of the four Gospels. Belief in Jesus' resurrection preceded the writing of the four Gospels. First, the New Testament epistles. The earliest New Testament books are some of the letters, some of the epistles. And probably the earliest is Galatians, written by Paul in AD 49. You can ask me where I got these dates from later if you like. but I think these dates are on the mark. Galatians AD 49, 1 and 2 Thessalonians AD between AD 50 to 52, that time frame. 1 Corinthians AD 53 to 54, 2 Corinthians probably in AD 55. Now, all of those New Testament books demonstrate a belief in Jesus' resurrection. In all of them, Paul says Jesus rose from the dead. Galatians AD 49, that's less than 20 years after Jesus' crucifixion, probably crucified in 30 AD or 33 AD. But not only do they demonstrate a belief in Jesus' resurrection, but that belief is fully integrated with the theology and practice that is taught in those epistles. So it's not, belief in Jesus' resurrection isn't an ancillary belief that you've got Christianity's core beliefs and then kind of resurrection tacked on, but it's integral to what Christians believe. So to give you a couple of examples of that, from 1 Thessalonians 4 verse 14, Paul says, since we believe that Jesus died and rose again, in the same way, God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep. He's talking about Christians who have died and said, well, there's hope for believers who have died. When Jesus returns, he'll bring them with him. They will live too because Jesus died and rose. You see how Jesus' resurrection is made the foundation for other Christian beliefs. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 14, Paul just states it bluntly, if Christ has not been raised, then our proclamation is without foundation and so is your faith. It's foundational. Secondly, we find in the epistles what I've called early Christian formulae. That is, forms of words that seem to be well established by the time these letters are being written. So well established that they just kind of roll off the tongue for early Christians. God raised Jesus from the dead. Jesus died and rose again. These little formulae, I call them, pop up again and again in the New Testament. And they just seem to express the common faith of believers. And thirdly, in 1 Corinthians 15, we have what is a pre-Pauline creed. That is, a creed that was in existence before Paul became a Christian, in all likelihood. Now, this is very, very significant. Let's have a look at it. It's 1 Corinthians 15, 3 to 7. And in verse 3, Paul says to the Corinthians, I passed on to you, as most important, what I also received. So Paul says, what I received, I passed on to you. This language of tradition. Paul received it and passed it on. What was it that Paul received and passed on? That Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, then to over 500 brothers at one time, then to all the apostles, then to James, then to all the apostles. And then Paul tacks on the end in verse 8, and last of all, he appeared to me. Now, Paul was in Corinth in probably in the years AD 50 to 52, so that's when he passed this on to the Corinthians. So he received it before then. The most likely time that Paul received it is around AD 37, which is when he first visited Jerusalem again after he had become a Christian. You might know Paul was he was a Jewish Pharisee who was persecuting the church. He was trying to arrest Christians and throw them in prison. And while he was on his way to Damascus to do just that, Jesus appeared to him on the road and he was converted. He turned from persecuting Christians to preaching about Christ, who he had met, the risen Jesus. And 3 years after his conversion, now that was probably about AD 34 or 35, 3 years after that, he went to Jerusalem and there met with Cephas, Peter, and James, the brother of Jesus. And it's likely at that time that he received this tradition. So these are tradition that is probably well established by the mid-30s AD. We're talking perhaps 5 years after Jesus' resurrection. Or Jesus' crucifixion. So why do I point out all this? To show you that I want to focus on the Gospels, but belief in Jesus' resurrection didn't spring up with the writing of the Gospels. Without any doubt, it predated the writing of the Gospels.
They didn't make it up. The evidence from the epistles is that belief in Christ's resurrection was early, widespread, and foundational. So the question I want to ask about the Gospels is, I want to ask about the Gospel, the narratives in the Gospels, the narratives of the empty tomb and the appearances. Of what historical value are they for determining what the earliest Christians believed? For determining what actually took place. Now, there's three things I'm going to attempt to do. I want to acquaint you with the resurrection narratives, what do they actually say. I want to introduce some of the tools that historians use in analysing the Gospels, and I want to apply those tools to the narratives. Now, I've kind of started to do those things already, but they're the things I'm trying to do, although they're all kind of merged together in this talk. So, content of the narratives, the tools historians use, and applying those tools to the narratives. All right, well, let's talk first. Oh, sorry, yep. What have I got here in the outline? The Gospel resurrection narratives purport to describe the events that gave rise to this belief. And here are some of the key questions we'll be asking. Did the evangelists, that is those who write the Gospels, did they use sources or did they invent things? Did some Gospels copy from others or are they largely independent? And how early are the traditions and sources used by the Gospels? They're the kind of questions we want to ask. We may not be able to answer them all, but they're the kinds of questions we want to ask. All right, well, let's think about the empty tomb. The empty tomb. When it comes to the empty tomb, I've got... how many things am I saying about that? Four things I'm saying about the empty tomb. First, in the accounts of the empty tomb, there is agreement on the basic outline of events. All four Gospels agree that early on that Sunday morning, the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and perhaps some other women went to the tomb. They found the stone had been rolled away. They encountered one or two angels there who gave them a message that Jesus had risen. In the tomb, they discovered that the body was empty. Sorry, I've added in one little detail that John differs on, but we'll get to that later. And you can see on one of the handouts I've given you, the one with the yellow highlighting, that I've lined up Mark, Matthew and Luke in a table, their accounts of the empty tomb. And I've got the rows there, A, B, C, D, down to K, showing there's a great deal of similarity between these accounts. Now, John's is a bit more complex. It's on the other side. In John's Gospel, Mary Magdalene goes to the tomb twice. Goes to the tomb once, finds it empty, goes back and tells Peter and another disciple. Peter and that disciple go to the tomb and find it empty. Then Mary goes back to the tomb, meets two angels, looks in the tomb, finds it empty, and then she has an encounter with Jesus himself, although at first she thinks he's the gardener. So there's this basic agreement on the outline of events. The second thing I want to say about it is that despite this basic agreement, there is surprisingly little direct verbal correspondence even between the Synoptic Gospels. Now, the Synoptic Gospels are Matthew, Mark and Luke, and they're called Synoptic Gospels because they follow a similar kind of chronology, so you can make a synopsis of them. You can put them side by side and line them up like I've done here. And even between these three Gospels, there's surprisingly little direct verbal correspondence. That is, the exact same words in one appearing in the other, or in the others. And this, I think, is significant because the general consensus, although some do, but the general consensus among historians is that Matthew and Luke had access to the Gospel of Mark, that Mark was written first, and Matthew and Luke had Mark's Gospel when they were writing their Gospels, and that they drew on it at multiple points. This is, if you can see that, there's a kind of standard model for thinking how the Gospels came together. I won't talk about it in great detail, but you see here that Matthew and Luke had Mark's Gospel, they used it. Matthew and Luke also had another source, which historians call Q, which they both used. And Matthew and Luke each had their own independent source of information that they drew on. And then here's John out here by himself because his Gospel is a bit different. So there's kind of a standard model, but how does that work out? I'll give you an example. Say the Transfiguration, which is one event in the life of Jesus. The Transfiguration, Mark, and the numbers here are for the Greek words, right? So I don't know how this will work out exactly with these numbers in English, but Mark's account of the Transfiguration uses 121 words. 72 words of those 121 are used by Matthew. Exactly. 47 of them are used by Luke in his account. When we come to the empty tomb, not only are the numbers few, so Mark's account, 136 words, of which Matthew uses 36 and Luke uses 27. So not only do we have smaller numbers, but there are kind of two things to notice about them. First, particularly with Matthew, those words very much, the common words, very much cluster around the message of the angels. If you look at that in line, and to a lesser extent, Luke as well, the lines F through to I on your sheets, the words of the angel, and you see all the yellow highlighting there for Matthew, as well as a little bit for Luke. The numbers in the brackets are the number of shared words that occur outside the speech of the angels. Only 10 for Matthew, 22 for Luke. So that's one thing to notice about these shared words. The other thing to notice is just that, well, let me think about it this way. If you were to read a couple of journalist reports on the Olympic events of the Olympic Games for yesterday, and you read these two reports, and they both contained the words Usain Bolt, 100 metres, gold, and sprint, you wouldn't conclude that one of the journalists had copied the other one. They're just the kind of words you'd need to use to say what had happened. Well, when you look at these words highlighted yellow here on your page, you see it's exactly the same. Like Sabbath, Mary, the stone, the tomb. I mean, these are the kinds of words that you'd need to employ if you are telling the same event. So I think there's remarkably little direct verbal correspondence which suggests that it's not a simple case of one evangelist copying another, just word for word, copying out what he wrote. There are other things going on here. Third thing to notice about the empty tomb narratives is that there are minor differences that rule out simple plagiarism or collusion. Now, I've got three there on your outlines. There are more, but three, that's about all we've got time to talk about. So first, the time of day. Each of the four Gospels uses different words to describe the time of day. So Matthew, as the day was dawning. Mark, very early in the morning. Luke, at deep dawn. John, early while it was still dark. Now, essentially, they're all talking about the same time of day, exactly the same time of day, and yet none of them use the same words. They're all describing it differently. Secondly, the women. The number of women and their names differs between the four accounts. In fact, no two Gospels agree on the number of women present. In Matthew, there are two who are named, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. In Mark, there are three, Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome. And Luke, there are five, Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary, the mother of James, and other women, so at least two others. And John, only one is named Mary Magdalene. And now what do we make of that? Well, for starters, it says it's not just a simple case of one gospel copying the other ones, because we've got these differences. There's these apparent discrepancies here. Is it a contradiction? Are these accounts just hopelessly confused and it's just contradictory because they can't even agree on how many women there are at the empty tomb or who was there? Well, I don't think you can call that a contradiction for the simple fact that a list of witnesses doesn't need to be complete in order for it to be true. It doesn't need to be comprehensive in order for it to be true. And let me give you two examples to demonstrate that even the writers of the Gospels operated with this kind of perspective. First, the men who visited the tomb. Luke and John both report visits of male disciples to the tomb after the women come back with their report. And it's not surprising, it's just the kind of thing you would have done if you were there, if you were one of those disciples. You would have run to the tomb to check for yourself. John mentions two disciples, Peter and the disciple whom Jesus loved. Luke names one disciple in verse 12 there, Peter. Got up, ran to the tomb. He stooped to look in and he saw only the linen cloths. Names only one. Peter is also named in John's Gospel. But when this event's talked about later on in Luke chapter 24 by the two disciples who are on the road to Emmaus, see what they say. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they didn't see him. So earlier in the chapter, Luke names only Peter. Later in the chapter, it's clear that there's someone else, at least one other person with Peter. I'll give you another example. John's account of Mary Magdalene at the tomb. John 20 verse 1. On the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb while it was still dark. She saw that the stone had been removed from the tomb, so she ran to Simon Peter. But what does she say to Simon Peter and the other disciple? They have taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they've put him. So again, we see in John's Gospel, although only Mary Magdalene is named, clearly there's at least one other woman there with her. So the fact that we've got different numbers of women named and different names given doesn't mean these accounts are contradictory. So what do we do about the differences? What sense do we make of it? Well, are these... is it just the case that each gospel writer is making up some names of women to try and bolster their account, to kind of make it a bit more substantial? I think that's unlikely for two reasons. First, there's the disappearance of the name Salome. If Mark is the first gospel written, why did Luke and Matthew not keep that name in their accounts? If they wanted to kind of have as many witnesses as they could to make it credible, why didn't they keep her in there? She disappears. Secondly, if the writers did feel free to invent witnesses, they wouldn't have invented women witnesses. Why would they have done that? Because in the ancient world, both among both Jews and Gentiles, the testimony of women, I'm sorry, ladies, but the testimony of women was regarded as unreliable. And you see this kind of across the board. So Josephus, a first century Jewish historian, says this. He says, "From women let no evidence be accepted because of the levity and temerity of their sex." Now, they're kind of too light-hearted and not serious enough, so don't listen to their testimony. Celsus is a second century critic of Christianity, and he called Mary Magdalene a hysterical female. She's not to be trusted. And even in, as you read Luke's Gospel, what happens when the women come back with their report? Luke 24, verse 11, "Their words seemed like nonsense to the men, and they did not believe them." See, men didn't trust the testimony of women. So if you're inventing witnesses, you wouldn't invent women witnesses. So what do we make of it? Why are the women named differently in the accounts? Well, I think the other thing to notice in the accounts, listen, there's different numbers of women, different women named. Another thing to notice is the prominence given to Mary Magdalene. She's there in all four Gospels, and she's named first in all four, which isn't surprising if, as John 20 says, she was the first person to see Jesus after he rose from the dead in the garden of the tomb. If that's the case, and she's the first witness of Jesus, it's not surprising that her testimony was prized and well known in the early church. But I think probably the best explanation for why different women are named is that given by Richard Borkham. The evangelists were careful to name precisely the women who were well known to them as witnesses to these crucial events in the origins of the Christian movement. Why did they name some women and not others? Because they're the ones those evangelists knew. They're the ones that particular gospel writer knew. Mark knew Salome's testimony. The others were not familiar with it. But Luke introduced the name of Joanna as one of the witnesses whom he knew or whose testimony he knew. That would make sense of the data we have in the Gospels. All right, let's move on. Other minor difference, the number of the angels. There's a bunch of things here. The number of angels in Matthew and Mark, there's one. In Luke and John, there are two. But again, I don't think that's really a massive difference. The angels are identified and described differently. In Mark, simply a young man dressed in a long white robe, not called an angel, although clearly intended to be understood as an angel. In each of the four Gospels, the word used for the clothing is different, and yet it's all clearly the same kind of thing. There's all this idea of white or brightness. The circumstances surrounding the women's encounter with the angels differ slightly. In Mark, Luke and John, the angels are first seen inside the tomb. In Matthew, first outside the tomb, and who then invites the women in to come and see, to enter the tomb and see. And then there's some differences in the angel's message, particularly between Luke and Mark and Matthew, and between John and the others. But I might talk about those things a bit later on. But what we see here are these kind of differences that show, they rule out plagiarism and collusion as the way the gospel narratives came together. Final thing we notice about the empty tomb narratives are unique emphases characteristic of each particular gospel. So Matthew alone mentions an earthquake, and he also has an earthquake at the time of Jesus' crucifixion. Matthew alone mentions the guards as present at the tomb, and that's something that he develops as he deals with the report that was circulated by the guards that Jesus' disciples stole the body. In Mark alone has this ends in this surprising way, in Mark 16, verse 8, where it says, the women said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. In all other three Gospels, the women tell what they've seen, but in Mark, they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Now, what's going on here? Well, there are two possible explanations. There's an historical explanation or a rhetorical explanation. The historical explanation is that they said nothing to anyone. It doesn't mean they said nothing to anyone. It means they said nothing to anyone else while they're on their way back to the disciples. They said something to someone, to the disciples, but nothing to anyone else because they were afraid. Being there in Jerusalem just a couple of days after Jesus' crucifixion, they didn't run through Jerusalem saying Jesus is alive. They were afraid, ran back to the disciples, told only them. Now, perhaps some support for that might be in Mark 1:43 and 44, where Jesus said something similar to a man who's just healed of leprosy. He says, see that you say nothing to anyone, but go and show yourself to the priest. So there, say nothing to anyone means say nothing to anyone, but go straight to the priest and show him. So that's the historical explanation. A rhetorical explanation is that Mark is playing on something here which is developed through a motif he's developed throughout his gospel, which is called the messianic secret. And that is where Jesus repeatedly commands people not to tell others about him. And it comes up sort of again and again, multiple points. But there's one example there where Jesus has said it to this man he's healed of leprosy. But there's multiple points where he does it. Often, when Jesus says that to people, they disobey him and go and tell everyone anyway. But the other thing that's happened through Mark's gospel is that Jesus has made it clear that after he's risen from the dead, that is the time to speak. That's the time to tell the things that the disciples have been learning. And if that's the case, maybe Mark ends his gospel this way to leave us feeling unsettled. Before Jesus told people to be silent and they spoke, now is the time he says, speak, and they're silent. So maybe it's for that rhetorical effect on us as we read it. That we think, hang on, this is not right. We've got to say, someone's got to say something, that Jesus is alive. In any case, we've got here another sort of minor difference with the other Gospels that shows they weren't just colluding. All right.
Luke.
A couple of things that are unique emphases of Luke's Gospel is the omission of any appearance of Jesus, or any prediction that Jesus will appear to the disciples in Galilee, and the full theme of fulfillment of prophecy. I think I've got to move through this a bit more quickly, so I won't say much more about them now. And for John,
the themes of seeing and there's Luke's theme of fulfillment, which he introduces in the very first verse of his book. He's writing about things fulfilled. In John, the theme of seeing and believing and the minor role played by the angels. In John, the angels appear only in verses 12 and 13 in Mary's second visit to the tomb. They're only there very briefly. And their words, the only thing they say is a question, "Woman, why are you crying?" They don't give Mary a message to take to anyone. They don't tell Mary Jesus is alive. Both of those things are deferred until Mary meets Jesus himself. Jesus does those things. And so, rather than being messengers, they're just kind of this dramatic, part of this dramatic build-up to the appearance of Jesus. In fact, they've got such a minor place, you almost wonder, what are they doing there? I mean, why are they still there? I suspect they're still there because they were such a well-established part of the tradition that John couldn't leave them out altogether, but he didn't want to major on them because he wanted to major on Jesus and his appearance to Mary. So we see these unique emphases. All right, what do we do with that? Initial assessment. There's broad agreement between the four Gospels. There are indications of independence, those differences I pointed out. And the way I've summarised that is that as they were writing, they wrote with editorial freedom, but with restraint. They do develop themes that are kind of significant, important to them elsewhere in their Gospels, and yet there's a restraint. They're still describing the same events. All right, I'm going to have to fly through this, I think. The resurrection appearances. A few things to say about them. None of the four Gospels claims to give a comprehensive list of appearances. So the fact that they give different appearances doesn't mean they're contradictory. There is agreement on the fundamental nature of the event. So the agreement on a number of things, on the fact that Jesus rose bodily. In Matthew, the women, when they see Jesus, hold on to him. In John, when Jesus shows himself to his disciples, he says, "You know, see my hands and feet, reach out and touch me. You know, put your hand in my side, Thomas." In Luke, again, he shows his hands. He eats fish in their presence to prove that he's not a ghost, he's flesh and blood. He's raised bodily. There's also the theme of worship, that Jesus is recognised as worthy of worship and of commission. In Matthew, Luke and John, Jesus sends his disciples out. That's one of the things he says to them when he appears to them after he's risen from the dead. So there's this agreement on the fundamental nature of what happened when Jesus appeared to his disciples. There's also agreement on many minor details, and I think this is very significant. You'll find one of the sheets I've given you is called the Criterion of Multiple Independent Attestation. Now, one thing historians do when they have developed is they look at the Gospels, they've developed what are called the Criteria of Attestation. They're just some basic rules of thumb to try and work out the relative historical merits of different things that we read in the Gospels. If you one of those criteria is the criterion of multiple independent attestation. That is, if there's an event or a motif that appears in multiple Gospels that are independent of one another, so we've got multiple independent sources of this event or this motif, then that gives us better grounds for thinking that it is authentic, that it's an early belief. And you can see how that works. It's just like the case of you're verifying one source of information by having another independent source of information.
Well, look at some of the things, and there's a list there. The ones about the empty tomb are in italics, but look at the ones about the appearances, Matthew and John, that Jesus appeared to Mary Magdalene or the women, that they held on to, the women held on to Jesus, that Jesus referred to his disciples, the disciples as his brothers, and that Jesus appeared to them in Galilee. In Luke and John, that Jesus showed himself to some disciples before others, that the Jerusalem appearances to the 11 or 12 disciples, this idea of Jesus suddenly appearing or suddenly disappearing, appearing even through locked doors, that Jesus greets his disciples by saying, "Peace to you." Jesus shows his hands. Jesus invites his disciples to touch him. He's initially not recognised. He speaks about the forgiveness of sins and promises the Holy Spirit. And in Matthew, Luke and John, that some disciples doubted, that Jesus commissions the disciples and that they worship Jesus. And then just for the sake of completeness, for Luke and 1 Corinthians, that appearance of Jesus to Peter, the individual appearance to Peter. Now, what do we make of this? I think there are two things that are very impressive about this list. One is the sheer range of motifs that are present in multiple independent sources. The sheer range of things. And the second is the variety of combinations that yield results. That you kind of stick any two gospels together and you've got some motif that they share in common that isn't in the other ones. What do we make of this? Well, I think it's a very strong case that Matthew, Luke and John are giving us independent information, sources of information about the same reality, the nature of Jesus' resurrection body and his appearances to the disciples. All right, unique emphases. All right, we've got some unique emphases there. I won't go, you've got them listed there, Matthew, Luke and John, I won't go into them. But the reason I point out those unique emphases in the narratives is this. It's clear that each of the four gospel writers felt free to adapt what they were recording in a way that suited their gospel. They could mention and focus in on themes that they developed elsewhere in the gospel. It's clear they felt that editorial freedom. We see those kinds of things coming up and the language used. But it was freedom within limits. They were operating within a sense of constraint. It wasn't an unbounded freedom. And you see that as you look at this criterion of multiple independent attestation. The fact that so many things are shared in common across the accounts. The other way you can see that it's freedom within constraints is because of some awkward inclusions and some surprising omissions. There are some things in the narratives that you just wouldn't include unless they actually happened that way. These, what are called surprising omissions. First one I've already talked about is that the women witnesses, that women are the first to see the empty tomb, and in Luke and Matthew and John, they're also the first to see the risen Jesus. Second is that motif of non-recognition, that in Luke and John, on a couple of occasions when Jesus is first seen, he's not recognised. Luke 24, verse 16, they were prevented from recognising him. John 20, verse 14, she didn't know it was Jesus. She supposed he was the gardener. Now, if you're writing an account to convince people that Jesus really rose from the dead, why would you drop in this little comment that, oh, and by the way, we didn't recognise him when we saw him? Well, doesn't that raise a big question mark? Is it actually Jesus that you're seeing? This thing, why would you include it unless it actually happened that way? And thirdly, the doubting of the disciples. That's there in Matthew, Luke and John. In Luke and John, admittedly, it gives an opportunity for Jesus to prove that he's really risen. But especially in Matthew, we're just given this little verse, Matthew 28, verse 17, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And then Matthew moves on. They worshipped him, but some... Hang on, Matthew. How many is some? Who are the Son? What exactly are they doubting? Were their doubts resolved? Well, those questions aren't answered for us. Why would Matthew just drop that in there unless it actually happened that way? These marks of authenticity. And then there are some surprising omissions, and I think I don't really have time to talk about this, but that is, at a number of places, we see that the kind of things that you'd expect to find if these narratives are being completely made up late in the first century AD, the types of things you'd expect to find are not there. There are not many scriptural allusions, despite the New Testament teaching that Jesus rose from the dead according to the scriptures. Well, why not slip in a few allusions to prove the point? There's the unusual nature of Jesus' resurrection body, appearing and disappearing, which we're kind of not given to expect that through the Old Testament. If anything, the Old Testament gives an expectation, what will resurrection bodies be? They'll shine like the stars. That's what Daniel says, Daniel 12. But there's also other ideas in the New Testament that aren't kind of emphasised in the narratives, that the resurrection body is incorruptible. So it's unusual, but it's sort of different from what we might expect if they're just making it up late in the first century. And the absence of personal hope, that is a theme that's ubiquitous elsewhere in the New Testament, is because Jesus rose from the dead, those who believe in him will rise from the dead. Jesus lived, so we will live. We have hope. And yet that's ubiquitous elsewhere in the New Testament, and yet it's not something that's developed in the gospel narratives themselves. Instead, we see other things like a commission, the commission of the disciples. Well, what do we make of all this? I think that the sound conclusion is that the gospel writers are not just making things up late in the first century AD, or 30 or 40 years after the event. What they're doing is reporting the testimony of eyewitnesses. The narratives they give us ring true as the kind of events that would have given rise to the early Christian belief in the empty tomb and Jesus' bodily resurrection. Far from being a late invention, the empty tomb and the bodily resurrection of Jesus were foundational traditions. They were central tenets of faith from the very beginnings of the Christian movement. And if belief in those two things, empty tomb and Jesus' resurrection, if belief in Jesus' resurrection is as early as it seems to be when we look at the New Testament, if belief is that early, then it raises the tantalising possibility, is belief, the belief that early, because that is how it actually happened. Well, I think I better close there. I'll offer a brief prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you that you have left us with this abundant testimony in the New Testament about Jesus' resurrection from the dead, that our doubts might be dealt with, that we might be given confidence, that we might believe that Jesus lives, so that we might put our faith in him. Amen.